Get ready for the greatest roast of all time. The Roast of Tom Brady. A Netflix live event happening May 5th. Hosted by Kevin Hart. The seven-time world champion gets his cleats held to the fire by famous friends and frenemies on an unforgettable night where everything is fair game. Tune in on May 5th at 5 p.m. Pacific time for The Roast of Tom Brady. Live only on Netflix.
You ready?
Showtime.
On May 3rd, summer starts with the Fall Guy.
What are you doing later?
Let's drink a spicy margarita.
Make some bad decisions.
Yes!
Audiences are falling in love with the most entertaining film of the year.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
Fall Guy.
That's what the poster said.
See Ryan Gosling and Emily Blunt in the movie critics say exists to make you happy.
Trying to make it out?
Nope.
Because I don't either. It's not what I'm into right now.
What are you into?
Talking.
Yeah.
The Fall Guy. Only in theaters May 3rd. Rated PG-13.
Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
It's only a kick. A jump. A block. It's only a serve. It's only a tackle. A run. It's only for the fans. After all, it's only pressure. You got this. Adidas.
Welcome back to another exciting edition of the Pointless Exercise Podcast. It's the Cub Podcast, and we have as our guest, we... Why do I say we? I have as my guest, that's a royal we, I guess. I have as my guest, my friend Tom Loxas of the Beers and Beat Guys podcast. Do you have anything else to plug? Is that your main outlet of your thoughts?
Yeah, that's it. That's it, yeah.
Now, so a couple of weeks ago you had a frequent guest, the guy who's been a guest on this more than any non-co-host, John Greenberg.
Okay.
And I joked. I'm like, did my name come up? I didn't really think that it would. And then I listened to it, and you guys talked about me more than you talked about the Cubs, which I appreciated.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess. I saw who your guest is on the most recent pod that you had released before we record this. I'm going to guess that my name did not come up with David Hough of the Chicago Tribune.
No. Are you? I wasn't sure what your status is with him.
We don't.
Like, although I assumed, yeah. Yeah.
that's what my status is.
I mean, that's the thing. That's
you guys talked Bears? Or did you talk Cubs?
We just talked Cubs. I'm only doing, Cubs on this one, but I just wanted some, big picture thoughts from him. Cuz I know he's not like grinding, the Cubs daily, so
no,
he's more like big picture stuff.
He's getting screamed at by Mike Mulligan every morning.
Yes.
That's what he's doing.
I mean, his life for the next 6 months is just going to be over analyzing Justin Fields. So,
speaking of that, this podcast has a Bears podcast, and it's going to come back. We're going to I haven't even confirmed it yet. The last couple of years I'd done it with Mike Pusateri, and we decided that one Mike P wasn't enough, so we added Mike Presnowski. So there's two Mike P's, which just to confuse me when I'm trying to direct questions to one or the other of them. That'll come back in a couple of weeks, so we're excited about that. But we will not stop talking about the Cubs, the playoff bound maybe Chicago Cubs. So I'm trying to think where I want to start. The last couple of days in Detroit, one win, one loss, I think we're both highlights of what I think is the limitations this team, self-imposed limitations this team faces by having David Ross manage them. Just kind of the inability to think on his feet and make like a quick decision. And it was really bad. Actually, I don't really blame him that much for what happened today, except one one part of it I will. But so we're recording this on Wednesday. On Tuesday, the Cubs started Drew Smyly. And even every fan was like, oh, God, this seems like a terrible idea. And he predictably was not good. But he was allowed to stay out there not being good and give up 7 runs in a game that they most likely win if they just pull him after he'd given up 4, like we all thought they were going to pull him. So I guess what are your thoughts on the managerial aptitude of the former Dancing with the Stars runner-up?
Yeah, I know we've talked about this before. Like, I feel like it's two different, you know, buckets for him. I feel like he is very challenged when it comes to, you know, managing the actual games and the day-to-day stuff. And then, you know, Greenberg and I actually talked about this too. I asked him, like, how much of that do you think are his decisions and how much of that is coming from the front office? Because the lineup, you know, we've, you know, gone over it on a daily basis on Twitter. It just still, I just don't get it. I mean, I know some people will come back and just say, like, you know, the lineup construction is not everything and you can look at it a lot of different ways. But, you know, Ian Happ, no matter how you look at it, is not a three hitter to me. Candelario hitting in the 7th hole since we got him doesn't make a whole lot of sense. Yeah, his use of Patrick Wisdom in certain situations is weird.
Like ever?
Yeah, all of it. Yeah, it's just there's just a lot to pick at. You know, I think he left, you know, Taillon in there a little too long today. But that's the kind of stuff that anybody, you know, we can critique. But yeah, like you said, I think it's his ability to think on his feet that drives me crazy, or lack of. But as far as like the clubhouse culture, you know, you got to give him some credit there. It feels like it is a good clubhouse. It feels like the team does play very hard and with a lot of energy. And I feel like that since they got Candelario, they're actually more, you know, there's more energy there. And I feel like they're playing with a purpose. I just, yeah. So it's kind of, for me, it's kind of like, those are the two most important things I look at in a manager. And sometimes you can forgive some of the, you know, strategy mishaps for, you know, the overall big picture. But yeah, when it comes down to it, when they're actually in a pennant race or in the playoffs and he makes a big gaffe like that, yeah, Jed's gonna be pissed and he's gonna hold his feet to the fire, I think, at that point. But yeah, right now I kind of like forgive a lot of the idiocy because of the you know, the way the team looks. Let's put it that way.
Yeah, I mean, I get it, but to me getting your players to play hard is like the bare minimum requirement mm-hmm. of a manager. That's what gets you immediately fired, is when your players check out. Unless you're the White Sox and Pedro Grifol, you get to manage all year even when your players don't give a shit. I just feel like this is, you know, there's no sure thing they're going to make the playoffs. They should. They've got two paths to get there. But like I think I wrote today, but it seems like he's intent on like steering them towards the ditch. And I think my big concern with him is that there will come a time when they can steal a game that they're going to need with the right move. And I have no confidence that he will make it. And we get all this stuff about, well, you know, he was a leader of men as a player. I mean, think about what a great leader you have to be a third string catcher and have guys respect you. I get it. He played for all these Hall of Fame managers. Well, it doesn't seem like he learned much from it. It doesn't seem like he was paying that much attention to the Hall of Fame managers that he played for. And I say that, and today, when, you know, Jameson Taillon's throwing a no-hitter, and then all of a sudden it's just hit, and they can't get him out before he gives up the grand slam. To me, my issue with it wasn't letting him pitch to the immortal Cary Carpenter. It was they get to that 3-1 pitch, and the first thing you think is, and I think JD actually said it, is if you walk this guy, it's not the end of the world, right? Like, this is the threat in their lineup, and if they get one run, you know, you can still come out of this with the lead. And then it's a typical 3-1. Well, here's a fastball. See how far you can hit it. And it turns out he can hit it kind of far. But it's not the first time we've seen the Cubs do that. Like, they played the Mets, where the only guy in the lineup that could really do any damage was Pete Alonso, and he just torched them for an entire series. They played the White Sox, where really the only guy in that lineup that could hurt them was Luis Robert, and he hits a game-winning home run. And it's like, how seriously, you can't figure out how to pitch around when a team only has one guy. You can't figure out how to have that guy not kill you. I mean, you harken back to, like, the best example the Cubs, I think, ever have of it is the series with the Nats where Joe was just like, Bryce Harper will not beat us. He won't. And he walked him, like, I don't know, I forget what it was. Like literally, like, eight times in a series. And it pissed poor Bryce off. But tough shit. The Cubs swept. At some point, you're going to have to, you know, make an out-of-the-box decision and telling your pitcher, I know it's 3-1 and the bases are loaded, but you can't give this guy a strike. You're gonna have to try to make him chase. And I don't know that he thinks fast enough to do that. Which is, and I mean, I joke, but he's got to be on that leaderboard that he's, you know, one of the all-time leaders in baseball in concussions. And we've got him, and we've trusted the team to him. So I don't quite get that.
No, and I agree with a whole lot of what you said. Believe me, I just, he drives me insane, and I don't trust him to make the right move in a big game. That's the only thing I was saying was that, like, I feel like, yeah, the playing hard thing might be not exactly what I'm saying, but I do feel like they play with energy, and I feel like the clubhouse looks like they all like each other. They all get along. And it could just be you know, the fact that they have a lot of good guys in the clubhouse too.
Yeah,
so I'm not trying to give too much credit.
Like, I mean, they literally tried to handpick guys who had those traits, and they did a good job in some, and they had some other glorified coaches that they've had to slowly get rid of, like Hosmer and Mancini and Tucker. I mean, those guys were there as much for, you know, well, it's and it just cracked me up that this guy that they couldn't get rid of Joe fast enough to bring in Ross, who was going to be a much better leader, supposedly, and this disciplinarian. And then it turns out they have to stack his team full of guys who will do that for him.
Yeah.
So I never
quite, I mean, you know,
I never quite understood that.
Yeah. No, I get that too. I think that's, yeah. But at that aside, I was going to say, I'll give him credit there because it's still his clubhouse and it looks solid. It does seem from afar that they respect him. Okay. So I'll just speculate that they do.
Yeah.
So
in the newsletter today, I linked to a Jed was on, although for the first 8 hours the podcast was up, it was Jen Hoyer. And it's funny, I looked at it in my feed and I thought, who's Jen Hoyer? I wonder if she's any relation to Jed.
What was this?
Oh, it was just a typo. He was on the Starkville podcast with Jason Stark and Doug Glanville, and they had a typo, and it was Jen Hoyer.
Cool.
But so I listened to it. Once I realized it was Jed, I listened to it. And I wrote a thing today, and I think people think I hate Jed just because I criticize Jed. It's like he's in the position where he's the glorified GM. Of course you're going to criticize him. To me, I think Jed is not he's a less talented but maybe more normal version of Theo. You know, like Theo is very polished. He was very, you know, he's good with the media when he wanted to talk to the media, but it's weird. Theo was really an introvert. Like, he didn't like doing that. He felt like he had to talk to the media. He didn't really want to do it because he wasn't comfortable, but he was good at it. He was like anything else. If he was going to do it, he was going to be good at it, and he was. Jed, I think, is just kind of a more personable, like, he just likes to talk. And when he was the deputy, nobody ever wanted to talk to him. They'd have press conferences where they'd introduce a player, and the joke was at the end of the press conference, any questions for Jed? No. And then they'd all leave. But anyway, so Jed was on, and he's a good interview in instances like that. And he told some funny stories. But one of the things he talked about was, and I agree with this, and it was Jason actually had the stats. The Cubs started 11-6 and then lost 20 of their next 35 games. No, 20 of their next 50 games, right? How many? They played 15 games under. God damn, I can't do math. And they got out of it. And Jed said it was just really impressive to see that even when they were playing poorly, the players thought they were a good team that just wasn't playing well, not a bad team. And I will begrudgingly give Rossi some credit for that. I guess I just like a guy who can do that and can tell his ass from a hole in the ground when you need to make a big decision late in the game, because it's inevitable. It's going to happen. And, you know, I talked about it with John. Yeah. I know you talked about it with John. At some point, the Grady Little moment is going to come. Mm-hmm. And or the Rick Renneria moment, whichever example that John was given at the time. And yeah. if you make the right decision, you're fine. And if you don't, you're out. And the point I had made with you, and I think I talked with John about it too, is that I made the point that Jed has never hired a manager. He didn't hire one in San Diego, and he didn't hire Ross. And I know John was like, well, yeah, but he had say. What I was saying is, if I'm Jed, and I ever think that my ass is on the line, you are not firing me before I get a chance to pick a manager. That was my thing. In other words, to me, the only time Ross really gets in trouble is if Jed thinks he's starting to feel some heat. And then he's like, you are not firing me while I've never got to pick a manager. I'm going to pick somebody. Even if all I do is like, hey, Andy Green, do you want to be the manager? I'm going to do it. That was what I thought.
No, and I got that. But I do feel like it's a little murkier with this one because, like John was saying, that you know, Jed was all in on Ross, and it was like their guy.
Yeah, I mean they.
And I don't think Ricketts would buy that. Yeah,
they got tired of Joe, and I can kind of understand that because I think Joe's a bit much. I love him.
Yeah,
but I think after 5 years, you're probably like, can you just get in the Winnebago and go?
Yeah, the circus was over.
But they just thought they had this guy who was just going to be the greatest thing, and. I haven't seen any evidence of that yet.
No. And what you've described is, you know, the full package of being, you know, like top tier managers, you know, like a guy like Terry Francona, where he, you know, he commands the clubhouse and still knows how to, you know, fucking manage a game. So those guys are hard to find. You know, we saw Dusty always had, you know, the clubhouse in pretty good shape up until, you know, 04.
Yep.
Everybody always wanted to play for him, and they still do, but I still can't forgive him for the way he managed, you know, the 03 NLCS.
See,
but
go ahead.
But I'm sorry.
Well, I was just going to say,
I think
one of the, I'm not going to compare Dusty and Ross. It's funny because they hate each other, which is great. And one of the things I like about David Ross was he played for Dusty in Cincinnati, and those two hate each other. Was there were always these Dusty guys that when you got Dusty, you had to go get. He had him with the Cubs. Yeah. He had him with the Giants. That's where he got his start. Then, you know, you have to get Ramon Martinez. And, you know, he has these guys. And then you go to Cincinnati, and you got to find a few of those Dusty guys. For that very reason, he needed guys in the clubhouse that he could trust. Dusty doesn't strike me as a guy who needs spies in the clubhouse. What he wants is, like, advocates. He wants guys who, when somebody starts bitching, can be like, you know what, buddy? You know, he knows what he's doing. You're gonna play. You might not play today. Every manager needs that. Dusty like had guys that it was very clear that when you got Dusty, there was some mediocre utility players that you were gonna have to pick up, and he was gonna play them. That was the worst part, that they were gonna get it back.
Yeah.
One of the interesting things Jed talked about was they talked a lot about the trade deadline and when he made up his mind and. You know, he basically said I believe the Cubs were 10 games under 500 on like July 17th or something. They're going to be, if they make the playoffs, the only team in baseball history that will make the playoffs being 10 games under later than that was last year's Mariners. And it makes sense. Now there's more teams. There's a better chance of a team being that bad that late. And Jed was basically said if the trade deadline had been that day, he obviously would have sold. Because they weren't, that didn't look anything like a playoff team. They just weren't going to do it. And obviously the team kept winning, and then he, for a while, they were operating on parallel tracks where they were talking to teams about trading Bellinger. They were talking to teams about Bellinger, they were talking to teams about Stroman, and at the same time, they were scouting teams, they were scouting players that if they got back into it, that they might acquire. But he said one of the interesting things about this was that was about the time Dansby was on the disabled list with his bad heel, and the Cubs were on the road, and Dansby was rehabbing at Wrigley and was bored and was, like, hanging out with the baseball operations guys, basically acting like an assistant general manager, asking a bunch of questions. And one of the things Dansby asked Jed was, why do we ever rebuild? Why do you need to rebuild in Chicago? You have resources. You should be able to build a farm system without bottoming out. You should be able to get attract free agents like me without bottoming out. I don't understand why, unless you're like 40 games out, you would ever consider rebuilding. Why would you tear it down a year after year for this incremental improvement in your farm system? And Jed didn't have a good answer. I kind of wonder.
Holy shit. I'm not. Wait, Jed said this on a podcast?
Yeah. He said Dansby was like, Dansby
said this out loud.
A guy who played for the Braves could is like, I don't get it. Why don't you just try to win every year? And, you know, what it did was it made, in my mind, goes weird ways. So what I thought of when you're talking about that was immediately think of the Cardinals, right? Like, here's this team that never has to, like, bottom out. Like, they'll have a bad year. Like, this year they're having a bad year. But they didn't get rid of everybody and try to start over. They just expect that they'll figure it out and they'll contend again next year. But I think the Cardinals missed a golden a golden opportunity at this trade deadline. And I could honestly, I started to think about it. I thought, oh my God, we could have looked back at this year as, oh shit. Because the best position player traded at the deadline was Jamer, which, you know, he's a nice player and I'm glad the Cubs have him. But I mean, come on, that's not the impact bat that people were looking for. It was going to be Bellinger. And when all of a sudden the Cubs are like, no, we're going to keep him because we think we're going to the playoffs. The Cardinals should have stepped up and basically said, look, we know we need to rebuild our pitching. Like, they just don't have enough pitchers, which is funny. Because last year's Cy Young Award winner they traded away, and it looks like this year's Cy Young Award winner, if Gallen wins it, they traded away too. But you would have thought they would have looked at it and said, all right, we don't need a 37-year-old first baseman. Like, we could basically, with Bellinger out off the market and nobody else coming on, Shohei's not getting traded, Cody's not getting traded, we can basically hold an auction for Goldschmidt. And then in one fell swoop, we can, like, rebuild our pitching staff, and then we can turn first base over to the world's oldest rookie. What's his name? Walker. Am I blanking on his first name?
Walker,
Jordan Walker.
Yeah.
And we could have looked back and said, God, remember when the Cubs decided not to trade Cody that year that they made the playoffs and got bounced on the first weekend, and the Cardinals instead loaded up, and they've got these, like, three pitchers now that we're going to have to face? They didn't do it. They just, they kind of tinkered around and traded their bad and hurt guys, and they didn't do it. And I thought, I'm glad they didn't do that. It didn't make any sense to me that the Cardinals wouldn't trade Goldschmidt or Arenado. But you hear crap down there about, oh, no, we want those guys to retire as Cardinals so they can wear the red jacket and come to the same. What the fuck? I mean, I thought the idea was... this guy used to be really, really good. He's still pretty good, but that's not good enough. But I guess that's not it. So maybe instead of the Cubs having to become more like the Cardinals are just becoming more like the Cubs. And that'll be the Cubs' advantage. They're just making poor decisions down there now.
Yeah, I mean, I do. I have to say, though, I am jealous of the fact that they never have, gone into rebuild mode. Like, regardless of what Theo and Jed did when they first got here, they had to do that. But... yeah, you could make the argument they didn't have to bottom out as much as they did this time, because I feel like we've gone over this way too many times.
Yeah.
But they waited too long to trade some of those guys. They could have made smart trades during the contention window that would have made them younger and still contended.
I think
I don't even want to get into that again. But
they were blind to their own the limitations of some of their players.
Mm-hmm.
They didn't want to accept the fact that, because a really good organization realizes at first, like, you should have that advantage. You see them every day. You see everything they do every day. And you're like, you know what? Maybe he's just good and not great. And maybe we should look to move. And they didn't. And, that's how they got. But it all worked out now. All the positions are, Anthony Rizzo left, but, Cubs have nobody at first base. Chris Bryant left. They have nobody at third base. But otherwise, everything worked out fine. So there was a move last night, which was basically inconsequential. But to me, it showed, like, the biggest it's my biggest pet peeve about Marquee, and there's a lot. I have a long list of them. And that was, I guess it was the seventh inning. I thought it was the eighth, but I guess it was the seventh inning. Talkman spot comes around. There's a lefty in for the Tigers, and Ross pinch hits Nick Madrigal for Mike Talkman. And to me, it's like, this will be good, like, fodder for Jim and Boog to talk about. Okay, why are you making this move? Why are you doing whatever? And they barely mentioned that it happened. And to me, it's like for two things. A, they get too caught up. They were doing their stupid. They were talking about Justin Bieber and Seiya's obvious shirt and just all this shit that we just get so tired of listening to. But the other thing was, it's almost like they just avoid it because they don't have to potentially criticize the manager. Because in my mind, by making that move, then it necessitated a bunch of other moves that, you know, aren't that drastic. But Talkman's out, Madrigal's in, Cody's going to center, Jamie's moving across to first base. When two batters later in that same inning, you had a guy coming up who's going to have to bat right-handed, who, if you look at the stats, is a much less productive hitter against lefties than Mike Talkman. It's Ian Happ. It's like it would be a really interesting conversation for the announcers of the Cubs to talk about, but they would never do this because, you know, but it would be, maybe Nick Madrigal should be pinch hitting for Ian Happ, not for Mike Talkman. But I guess my point is, Ross, I think for the casual fan, most of his moves don't get any scrutiny on the game broadcast. They're just things that happen.
Yeah.
It's not like, why did he do this? I wonder if maybe he should have done this instead. You don't have to like be a dick about it and go, oh, that's the dumbest move ever. But they don't really even analyze it. It's just kind of like, hey, if it works, that's a great move. If it didn't, oh, just tough luck. Every time. And so there was a Bleacher Nation today. Brad had a tweet. I don't know. Somebody pissed in his cornflakes this morning. And he was, basically his tweet was, I'm paraphrasing here. why do some of you sick fucks just have to complain about everything with the Cubs? And I said it much nicer terms than that. And then Cerami said,
yeah, I was wondering why he just didn't at you. You know, I thought he was gonna.
I just ignored it. Because what I wanted to say was, you know, why do you have to have the fucking pom poms out for everything that happens? Like, there is a happy medium. There are things in the game that make you really excited and happy, and other things you're like, why the hell would you do that? But Cerami said something about, which I just thought was wrong, and he's like, oh yeah, I've noticed that since the Cubs are winning and the normie fans are back and things are getting more toxic. My take on that would be the normie fans, whatever that is, aren't very critical. They should be deluding the critical people, right? Because they're just like, oh, hey, the Cubs are winning. This is fun. They're not out there all of a sudden hammering David Ross and Ian Happ and all that. So that's my job. But so here's a Galaxy Brain take by me. As I got to thinking about what he was basically saying, I think the problem with, there are a lot of fans who are really excited that the Cubs are relatively successful again. That, you know, their games are important. Wrigley's fun again because there's big moments. You know, that's all, that stuff's great. That's what we watch. But I think it's inevitable. You're not going to have the same kind of engagement. We just had it seems like a million years ago, but 7 years ago we watched a World Series team. We know what that looks like. We know this isn't that. Like, this is much better than what we had been seeing. But nobody is fooling themselves that they've built this great juggernaut. But I think the part of the problem with the engagement with this current team is Marquee. They're, so much of it is either bad or boring. Like, the pregame show, there's nothing there. The postgame show, I always joke about it, but I do it. As soon as the game's over, I change the channel. I don't want to watch that postgame. Even if it's, and it sucks. Like, you have a huge moment, Christopher Morel, you know, with the walk-off homer, and he goes crazy, and you watch the replay a million times, and then as soon as they go to Cole and whoever, it's like, I don't need to watch this. What else is on? That has to hurt the fan engagement, right? And then the game broadcasts are, and I know that those of us who watch all the time just nitpick them, but you can't tell me that they're not getting worse. and the overall quality of the way that most of us take in the games, you know, you can only go to so many games. And radio, that they do a fine job except for the fifth inning on radio. But that's, radio's never been less important for a baseball team, because there's so many ways you can just, you know, it used to be that if you were out of your house, the only way you could follow your baseball team was on the radio. Well, now you, on your phone, you can still watch the game if you want. You don't necessarily have to listen to it. Right. And I feel like it's a marquee is such a huge missed opportunity. And until they get rid of the two clowns that they brought in to run it, who have no clue what Cub fans actually want, I think they're going to continue to miss on a big segment of Cub fans who are really looking. Maybe they don't even know exactly what they're looking for, but they know it's not this. They're looking for a way to engage with the team more and learn more about the team and watch, and you know. And they watch the stuff on Marquee, and after a few minutes, I was like, "Well, this isn't what I want." And now maybe I'm just full of shit. But I mean, I know that's my experience with it.
Like, I know you've been more critical of Boog lately, and I feel like I think Boog is pretty, you know, pretty damn good. And I know that he is at times, because I used to really enjoy him, you know, when he used to do the national games. But the whole broadcast in itself is like a lot of fluff.
Yeah.
You know, and I know that comes from is it McCarthy?
Yeah, it's the two.
Is he from like the Yes, Mike, you know, McCarthy network and thing? Mike Santini. Yeah. That's like their vibe though, right? That's what they're known for, is just like this, you know.
They came in and their whole thing was going to be, they were going to do
national
like
a broadcast.
Yeah. And fans don't want that. And no. The fact that they couldn't figure that out, and that, what is this now? This is the fourth season, right, of Marquee. The 4 years in, they still haven't figured it out. They're a lost cause at this point. Until leadership changes there, nothing's going to change that's going to make that better. And I think my problem with Boog is probably, I'm going to be charitable here, because I always liked him too. He can call a good game.
Yeah,
I think the tone that they set for that broadcast brings out the least interesting parts of him. Like, how many fucking times do we have to hear him tell the same two Mike Tauchman stories? Well, you know, Mike Tauchman told me he's not trying to take pitches, he's just trying not to swing at balls. I know you think that's profound, it's not. And then the one that cracks me up is the one he was talking about, how he said, well, I realized I was, you know, more advanced than other people was when I was at Bradley and I was sitting on the bench next to a teammate, and I was talking about how I could, you know, well, you can tell the difference between his changeup and his curveball. And the guy's like, you can read spin? I can't read spin. And I thought, well, that just shows that Bradley has bad players. That's what that that's what that anecdote tells. I don't need to hear the story.
That's pretty fair.
I don't need to hear the story about Julian Merriweather's nickname every time it comes out. I also don't need you and whoever the analyst du jour is to sit there and fake that you can't understand why the Blue Jays would give up on a guy who walked more batters than innings pitched for the whole time he was in Toronto and was hurt half the time. You know, there comes a time when a team has to cut bait on a guy, and credit the Cubs for getting a lot out of him. But it's like, okay, you've made that point. And here's where this is what this reminds me of. This is bad for Boog. The other Cub announcer who used to repeat stories over and over again, like we'd never heard him, was Chip. Chip did the same thing. Like, and he, especially if the Cubs were on, you know, they were on Fox Sports, Chicago, and GN, and they would be on back-to-back days. And he would act like there was two completely unique audiences, and he can just bring out the same crap for game two. And it's like, buddy, 80% of your audience heard this yesterday. I just think with Boog, it's the vibe that he's been told to give. And, you know, we talk about trying to shoehorn Taylor in all the time. It's like, just if it's not a natural part of what's going on in the game, stop it. Because now you're to the point, you know, they had the luxury basically the first 3 years of there weren't, other than the pandemic year, which was just a weird thing, there weren't any, like, you get late in the season, there weren't any big moments. So you could just do your, you know, half-assed chat show broadcast. Well, the games are important now. And you've, at some point you have to shift into, this is a big game. And there's big strategy here, and we're going to talk about it instead of talking about shoes or whatever the hell else it is. I don't I don't get it. And it, you just watch the games and you're like, all right, I guess we got to put up with this shit again. And yeah, I
is
guess.
There, is there anything to like, that's part of why Len left? From, I never thought about that before.
From what I understand, Len felt like the Mikes didn't appreciate him. And not in a, I don't like Len. And basically a, I think he felt like they viewed him as a very unimportant part of the broadcast. And I think his concern was, I'm going to be the one that decides when I go. And if an opportunity comes up, I'm going to take it. And he took it. We joke about he didn't like to have to wear the shirt and tie, which was stupid, but that's not why he quit. I think JD had the same feeling. I think he felt like they just looked at the game broadcasters like just two cast members in a play, and they could be replaced at any point, and it really wouldn't change the show. Mm. And I actually think that Len leaving might have made them be like, oh, shit, you know, people are mad. Maybe we should try to keep Jim. And I don't know how much of this is Jim basically saying, like, I don't want to work this many games anymore. Or how much of it was them being like, no, we need to, like, work in other analysts. But, you know, he's gone a lot. And we miss him because he's clearly by far the best one they have.
Yeah. Although I do have to say, I think I've told you this before, I do enjoy Sutcliffe only because he injects a little bit of that, you know, that realism, you know, that we grew up with, you know, like just like you don't know what they're going to say next kind of thing. Like
yeah,
whether it
well,
be Harry Carey or, you know, Lou Boudreaux. Like there's just something there where he just doesn't, you know, he doesn't give a shit. Like he'll just say what he's thinking. And I kind of miss some of that old school, you know, broadcast rather than being all like fluffy and polished, you know. So I think that's, you know, a lot of the Cub audience does not really appreciate a lot of these, you know, yuck it up moments. Yeah. Haha, the Justin Bieber t-shirt. I don't need that shit. I really, you know, it's like.
No, and it wasn't even, that was
every once in a while. Yeah.
But even that was day two of the Justin Bieber talk. It's like,
I know.
You talked about this yesterday and it wasn't interesting.
Ground.
Why is it back?
Yeah.
My problem with Sutcliffe is everything's great. Even to the point where you're like, oh, come on, Rick. This guy is not, except for Ildemaro Vargas. The one guy he hated Ildemaro Vargas. That was really entertaining last year. There was that one whole series, I think, at San Diego where everything was Ildemaro Vargas' fault. But I mean, it's kind of like, it's like, okay, Rick, here's the thing. If everything's great, then nothing is great. You know, you have to, there's no context to anything. I was talking to this guy. He's going to hit four homers today. No, he's not. And yes, we know your grandson's name is Ryder, and he's probably at the game today. We don't need to hear six Ryder stories either. I don't. So another topic, and this was your fault that I even knew that it happened, was, they're not the only ones who talked about it, but Bleacher Nation wrote a thing, I guess yesterday, Tuesday, or maybe it's Monday, I've lost all track of time. People are starting to talk about it, so now it's like, okay, the Cubs, obviously, they need to re-sign Cody Bellinger. Like, I think we all realize that. Like, he's got them over a barrel because he's a really good player, and they really, if he leaves, then there's big problems with this lineup. But they're also a big market team who has made their intentions known through the usual suspects, Bruce Levine, that they're going to make a serious offer for Shohei. And there were a couple of things. There was this weird article that they wrote where it was like, they should go after him, and I think they could probably get him, but they might not be able to get him, and maybe they could get him, and then they could go after Cody, but what if the timing for Cody gets messed up by going after Shohei and Oga? And you read it, and you're like, I don't know what I just read. But the thing that cracked me up today was this whole thing about, I hope they get the timing right, because they're going to make a big offer for Shohei, and then what if Cody signs while they're still talking to Shohei? And I just, it made me laugh out loud, because I'm like, we don't have 30 years of Scott Boras track record to know how this is going to work. Like, his entire game plan for Cody Bellinger is this. At the beginning of free agency, everybody's going to throw huge offers at Shohei, and only one team is going to get him. And you're going to have like these other four or five teams who made these huge offers to Shohei who now have nothing to show for it. And there's Scott Boras going, like, I know you offered this much to Shohei. Oh, how about 80% of that offer for Cody Bellinger? What a bargain. It's like, of course he's going to do that. That's like the biggest guarantee. Yeah. Cody's going to be one of the last players to sign because that's how Boris wrings the most amount of money out of free agency for his best one or two players every offseason. We've seen it time and time again. And it just cracked me up that they were like, oh, the Cubs are going to, there's going to be this delicate calculus. They're going to have to thread the needle. It's like, that needle is going to be the size of Iowa. You could just, you know, everybody's going to be able to get through that needle because Boris is going to make sure that anybody who wants to make an offer on Cody Bellinger has plenty of time to make an offer on Cody Bellinger.
Yeah. I mean, look, I got a lot to say about this. First of all, Shohei's probably got to be the first domino to fall in free agency because otherwise everyone's going to be waiting.
Yeah.
All their plans are going to decide whether they get this guy or not because he's a you know, starting pitcher. He's a top 10 starting pitcher and one of the top, you know, hitters in baseball. So you could, you know, fill a lot of needs if you get him. But as far as, yeah, and as far as the article goes, I was relieved though, and I shared that with you, that the position overlap would not be an issue if they wanted to sign them both. That made me, you know, have a sigh of relief because I was like, well, that settles that. Because,
yep.
Yeah, I was worried about that for a minute. But the thing with Cody, and I'm just going to throw this out there because I know it's not going to happen, but, and I kind of asked David Haw, not about this particularly, but I did say, look, you know, Shohei obviously is, I still think he's going to go to the West Coast. So do the Cubs still keep in, you know, Boris's ear that Bellinger's their number one target and hope that Bellinger, you know, kind of drives himself to where he wants to go. But, you know, it's all going to be about the last dollar. But the bottom line is I was just going to say, like, they need to stay focused on Bellinger because they can't afford to lose them both. And my biggest fear is what you said. There's going to be some team that's going to be holding on to $500 million that didn't get their guy. That's going to turn around and be like, well, fuck it. Let's just give $300 to Cody.
Yep.
And that's where I draw the line. Yeah.
And that'll be Boris's strategy. Now, it will be. Yeah. But the misnomer about Boris is always that people, and I think in Chicago, it's because Jerry Reinsdorf successfully made him the boogeyman for everything, right? Like the White Sox literally wouldn't mm-hmm. negotiate with him for players. And it was, you know, he. It's like, okay, well, you realize that the players work for him, right? And his job is to go out and solicit offers and give them advice. But at the end of the day, the player picks where they go. And I think the Cubs, unfortunately, are going to rely on the feeling that they're going to make a good offer for Cody, but it's probably going to get topped by somebody. But Cody's going to decide that it's a lot of money either way, and he's comfortable in Chicago, and he wants to stay. And I think there are people out there who think, well, Boris won't let him do that. And that's the part I laugh at, because Scott's not standing there going, you can't do that. You know, that's not his job. His job is, I would advise you, I think this is a better deal, but here's you're making a decision between these two things. He doesn't make the player's mind up for them. And I know Bruce made some headlines for something I think he reported accurately, but people didn't want to parse what he wrote. It's very hard the way he communicates. When he said that Cody's not going to sign an extension with the Cubs.
Yeah,
he meant that exactly the way he wrote it, which is he's going to be a free agent. He's not going to sign before free agency, which is what an extension is. That doesn't. Right. But some people took it to mean, oh, God, he's not going to come back. That's not what Bruce was reporting. Bruce was basically reporting that if there ever was a chance, I don't think there was, there's no chance anymore. Like, he's not going to be like, okay, I like it here with the Cubs. I'm going to sign this extension, and I'm not even going to bother with free agency. Like, he's going to free agency. And that's all Bruce was reporting. But there were a bunch of people who were like, oh, God, he's already gone. It's like, well, no, that's not what he meant.
Yeah, and I think Nightingale even said that recently, too. And, yeah, that obviously it's not going to happen.
Yeah. Oh, yeah, but, right. Maybe it was Bob and not Bruce. It was one of my
okay. Pets. Well, maybe. Yeah. Well, the thing about Bellinger, though, is he's probably, you know, even if he does love it here, you know, if it comes down to, like, a substantial amount of money difference. I mean, come on.
No,
he's not going to walk away from that just because he loves being on the Cubs.
Yep. I mean, he can learn to love it other places if the money's right.
What I did say to Haw is they can't come away without a big bat in that lineup. You know, if they're not going to get Shohei and they're not going to re-sign Bellinger, they're kind of back to square one in terms of finding a star in the middle of the lineup. Because there's no other player on this lineup that can carry it.
I mean, you could argue they would be in worse position next year than they were going into this year. Because they thought Hap was going to be more productive than he is. And, I mean... And so you look at it and like, okay, well, we can hang our hat on Seiya and Hap. And you look at those two guys and you're like, you can't hang anything on either one of them. And there's nothing you can do about it. They have both of them have no trades for the next 3 years. So they're your right and your left fielder for the next 3 years after this one. So you've got to be able to find that bat at either first, third, or center, basically. Yeah. And you've got one guy who can play both spots. And he's good. And maybe you'd try to keep that guy.
Well, I don't want to think about that. But because, I mean, I don't think Bellinger is all that replaceable for the Cubs because he does so many things well for them. But they might have to put together a package to go get like a Pete Alonso and then use the free agent money on a pitcher. Because I think in the scenario where they keep Bellinger, then I think they trade for a pitcher rather than spend big money in free agency. Because they've got the prospects now.
At some point, that 40-man roster crunch, you got to move some of those guys. You can't keep them all.
That keeps me up at night.
the 40-man roster crunch such a thing that the Cubs currently have 37 guys on their 40-man roster.
I'm very thankful of all the people on Twitter that can keep track of that stuff because I just don't have time for that. But at the same time, I love being. You're on top of that.
Yeah. Just go
but
to
yeah, the, no, there's
just go to that Arizona Phil page and you can see who needs to be added and who doesn't have to be added and who's on it and what happens if you let him go and that he keeps track of that for us. We can just be smart asses and do whatever we want. But it's always funny. Last year this whole thing about oh my God, what if they lose this guy? And one of the guys that they released to open a spot on the 40-man and then brought back is Mark Leiter Jr. The entire league looked at him and went, no, we don't need that. And he's been... he's been very... they'd be screwed without him.
Dude, he's like a legitimate left-handed reliever specialist that's not left-handed.
Yeah.
He's really good. I don't know how he does it. I watch him just like, this is going to fall apart one day really soon, but it just doesn't happen.
No.
He's been really good.
I mean, he's one of those guys who the likelihood that he's as good next year again as he was this year is nil. Because you see that all the time, right? Like guys, like Brian, remember Brian Dunsing was amazing and then terrible.
Oh, yeah.
And there's a list of that that's long as your arm of guys who, relief pitchers who put it all together for 1 year and are great. And then everybody's like, ooh, this guy's good. And then just... something happens in the winter and they show up in the spring and they're like, shit, I can't find it. And they never find it.
Right. Now Merriweather, on the other hand, I think the opposite. Like that guy, I used to watch him pitch for Toronto and be like, well, how the fuck is this guy not like great? Because he just has the stuff. So that guy, I actually do believe they may have like stumbled upon something.
But don't worry, it could in a couple of weeks, Brad Boxberger could be back.
Oh boy,
that'll save it. So the last thing I want to talk about real quick is the there is no 40-man September rosters, but there is a 28-man September roster, and only one of you can only carry 14 pitchers. So the Cubs have 13, like every team does. So on September 1st, they can add a pitcher and they can add a position player, and you can still shuttle guys back and forth. But I was thinking, I just don't think they're going to do this. The whole idea that, well, they're going to bring Pete Crow Armstrong up to be like this little Swiss Army knife. Because I was like, they're just going to bring Miles Mastroboni back because, he can cover the outfield in a pinch. And if, Dansby and Nico run into each other, he can play shortstop for the rest of the game. But then they did the thing I didn't think they'd ever do, which was they told Tucker Barnhart to go away, and they brought Mastroboni up, and now all of a sudden they don't need – they only have two catchers, and they might – they can bring anybody up to be that position player. Your best guess, do you think we're going to see the debut of Pete Crow Armstrong on September 1st?
Yeah, I really do. I feel like – I think think Carter Hawkins has kind of like let that cat out of the bag like a couple times, and I just feel like it does make sense, you know. And I think that I think we'll also see either Jordan Wicks or Little, the other lefty that they have in the system. Either one of those guys,
the 6'8" guy named Little.
Yeah, I think either one of those guys is going to make either, you know, an impact on the bullpen or the rotation the rest of the way. And I think they should use it because, yeah, these games matter right now, and those guys can help you win games, and use them however you can. I mean, I don't trust Ross to use them in the right way, but at the same time, yeah, fuck it, man. Throw them in there. And, you know, PCA definitely looks like he's ready, you know, so hell yeah. I think we will, and I think they should.
So he's got there's a couple of considerations with him. Number one, talking about that 40-man roster crunch, he doesn't have to go on at this offseason. So there's people like, oh, they don't want to use up his rookie, whatever. There's no way, even if he came up today and played every day, he wouldn't be able to play enough to not be a rookie next year. You don't have to worry about that. And obviously, if you're going for a playoff spot, you're not worried about one spot on the 40-man, especially for a player you think is like your center fielder of the future. You just, when he's ready, you get him. But to me, a more important thing is before they call him up, he's got to figure out something to put on the back of his uniform that fits. Because aesthetically, I cannot watch a guy whose name is a circle around his number. And Crow Armstrong is just way too long. And if I were him, I would tell them I want PCA on my nameplate. I would just completely lean into that and be like, no, just use my initials. My name doesn't fit. The Encarnacio Strand for the Reds, when his first game with the Reds, his whole name was on his jersey, and it looked ridiculous. And game two, he just had Encarnacion. Poor Strand got the boot. It's like, I don't know if you remember that from The Office, Jan, her real name, or when the show started, was Jan Levinson Gould. And she walked in one day, and she had a meeting, and Michael introduced her, and so this is Jan Levinson Gould. She goes, oh, it's just Jan Levinson. And he's like, ooh, what happened to Gould? What happened to Gould? And I could picture somebody having to go, what happened to Armstrong? What happened to Armstrong? You're just Crow now.
Yeah, I don't think that would look good. And I, not only am I a big like uniform like aesthetic person, but I'm also a little touched with OCD. So that would, both of those things would bother me. I couldn't handle it. I really hope he does something different.
I think it would be uncomfortable because those are sewn on letters and your entire back. It's like he's basically,
might slow him down.
It's like he's wearing a Sons of Anarchy cut, basically. There's just patches all over his back. I'd be like, all right, I can't, Pete's 0 for his first 14 because every time he goes to swing, like the A's on his back stick together and it hinders his movement. So I'm going to have a talk with him. I'm going to go down and talk to my buddy Alex Cohen. We're best friends on Twitter. And I'm going to talk to him. I'm going to get an audience with Pete. And I'm going to basically lay this out and say, buddy, I know you love your mom and your dad, but you got to pick. Which one do you love more? Because that's the one going on the back of your jersey. But that's why I'd go with the initials. They let PCA, Ichiro put Ichiro on the back.
Yeah.
So.
Yeah, I don't know. I don't know if they'll let him do the PCA, but... it's a thought.
Yeah. Or just go without.
Which number are the Cubs going to pick for him? Go ahead. I'm sorry.
I was going to say, the Hall of Famers, you can pick to not have a logo on your hat. No name on the back. The one Cub doesn't have a name on the back of his jersey. That's a good question, right? And he's in the minors. He's had to wear a different number. He wore 5. The Cubs have a 5.
Well, the Cubs always used to try to like pick a number to make the player like somebody, that they envisioned him to be. Like Kerry Wood got 34 for Nolan Ryan, and I always felt that way. Like Pryor got 22 because of Seaver, or who am I thinking of? Was it Seaver? No, wait. Was it Seaver I was thinking of? I don't remember. Somebody, it was somebody else I was thinking of. That maybe it wasn't Pryor, but I think they gave.
So does this go back
to? Did they give Gray 17? Keith Hernandez? Yeah, I don't know. Maybe. But I always just felt like they give, you know, they gave like Corey Patterson 20 because of Lou Brock. I just always had that in my brain that they're like, oh, okay, they're getting kind of cute with the number like that. So Sosa 21. I mean, did he wear 21 with the White Sox?
He's 25, I think, with the White Sox.
Okay, I was gonna say I thought 21. Maybe he wanted it for Clemente, or they did that,
right? That's what he wore.
Yeah. So yeah, I just didn't know who they. Well, Pete Armstrong will. I mean, I haven't seen him play that much, but yeah, there's been a lot of Lenny Dykstra.
They already gave away
comparisons, so yeah.
They gave 9 to Jamer, so he won't be able to wear that for Damon Buford. Gary Matthews Jr. was 19. The Cubs have a 19. Oh, that's Hayden. I don't know, all the good ones are taken. If they're going to have him try to emulate great Cub center fielders of the past, he's going to have to go back to either Hack Wilson or before there were numbers. So I think Pete gets off easy. He gets to pick whatever he wants. Yeah, pitching-wise, Smiley is penciled in for Sunday, but Jordan Wicks was a healthy scratch for his start in Iowa.
Yes.
So the intrigue.
That is encouraging.
I don't know how you can do that again. Like, just, you need a lefty in the bullpen. No. Smiley was fine in the bullpen. Put him back there, and somebody else has to make those starts. You can't give up 7 runs in 3 1/3. And, you know, these are winnable games you're handing away because you're just too stubborn to try something else. All right. Well, I know you have a podcast to record after this one. You're doing double duty.
Yeah.
So.
Yep.
Thanks for coming on. It's always a pleasure.
No.
So the Beers and Beat Guys podcast, a podcast that I am occasionally a guest on. You guys can find that.
Yeah. Right. No, Andy's a regular guest, and I actually probably am going to ask you to come back on soon. So
yeah I asked you to be on this podcast, and you were like, "Damn it! I was just about to ask you to be on mine."
Yeah. So,
it's my turn. I got to have you this time.
I'm honored. Thank you.
All right. Well, thank you, Tom.
Thanks, man.
Many of us have herpes.